Hello, I'm Andy Burnham and welcome to Sparks. Well, this week, radio faces a satellite invasion. Can Russian industry catch up in high technology? Atomic-sized switches? Can they be serious? We look at the world of the small TV producer. They have the ideas, but not the money. Pirates on Coronation Street. And we enter the world of the dust mite and the problems of asthma sufferers. The latest news from Radio Caroline, and of course your letters. So stay tuned, it's Sparks from Radio Fax. In Music Business International, radio faces satellite invasion. A market report on the Benelux.
Satellite radio broadcasters look set to make further inroads into the Dutch radio market. Radio 10 Gold, which broadcasts its signal from Italy, and Sky Radio have already established themselves as alternatives to the state terrestrial channels Radio 2 and 3. And more are due to follow. Luxembourg's RTL4 is already making test transmissions, and Radio Nationale Noordzee, RNN, is reported to be looking at establishing a satellite service. Sky Radio has followed its easy listening, no DJ format, with a top 40 channel hit radio, and 10 Gold has Power FM. Satellite stations have to be picked up inside Holland and fed into the cable network, which limits the audience to home listeners, but it offers an alternative to the national channels of Radio 2 and 3, which take their programming from different companies on each day of the week. The main pop channel, Radio 3, uses 8 different broadcasters. Ferry Mart, radio head of music and entertainment at TROS, which broadcasts on Thursdays, remember Ferry Mart from Radio Veronica, believes this pressurizes schedules. We have to put a whole week's entertainment into one day. Our aim is to make the programming so interesting that listeners will follow us throughout the week when we switch to Radio 2, for example. People have got used to that here. But while this encourages diversity, it makes the job of promoting a song particularly difficult, says Dries van der Schoot, head of international promotion at Phonogram. It would be much better if the system changed. If we're getting airplay from one of the stations for one piece but not for the others, it makes no sense. We have to wait for the next week for the song to come round again. But record companies have come up with a way of ensuring many of the local stations use their music. There are around 500 local radio stations broadcasting on cable networks. These are often funded by political, religious and community organisations. The Edison Foundation, which gives the yearly Edison Awards, and the private broadcasters organisation OLON produce a weekly vinyl sampler, which contains the new releases from Dutch record companies and has open-ended interviews with stars. Biographical and discographical information accompany the sampler. The sampler provides a cost-effective way of ensuring that the smaller private stations use music in their programming. On average, it contains 12 tracks, which are played by stations around 4 times each per week. At present, the samplers are pressed by Sony at its vinyl plant. Yet, as the stations move towards using CDs, the cost of making a CD sampler and the time it would take to produce it could put the scheme in danger. That report on the situation of radio in Holland from Music Business International.
You're listening to Sparks from Radiofax on 6205 and 12255. A letter now from Spain. Arturo Fernandez Larella writes from Malgra de Mar. Listening to your station, I could listen to another station which broadcasted via Radiofax. That station was Radio Jackie. Unfortunately, I haven't got Radio Jackie's address. Could you send me that information, that address? Thank you very much in advance. I hope for your news, and greetings from Spain. Well, Arturo listens on an ICF 7600DS, and he reports good reception. We've written to Arturo, and this also should answer your question about Radio Jackie.
16 years of Radio Jackie. This LP record traces the story from early operations in fields, through High Street Studios, to the final close down.
Police with tracker dogs and post office detection men raided a pirate radio station in South London yesterday. Radio Jackie, which was said to broadcast for 6 hours every Sunday afternoon, was manned by about 15...
On March the 7th, 1972, Radio Jackie made parliamentary history when a tape of the station was played to a committee of the House of Commons during a debate on the Sound Broadcasting Bill. This tape, the first ever to be played in the House, was used to illustrate how commercial radio could sound if it were legalised in Great Britain.
Radio Jackie, Jackie, Jackie,
the station that fits snugly into your ear.
Radio Jackie. the sound of Southwest London. Radio Jackie, the sound of Southwest London.
This is Channel 4.
A new crackdown on pirate radio by the Independent Broadcasting Authority. But is the IBA acting in the public interest?
This is Angela Rumbold, Member of Parliament for Mitcham and Morden. As many of you will know who are regular listeners to Radio Jackie, the government has introduced legislation recently which may put Radio Jackie's future at jeopardy.
From the bustle of suburbia to the rolling Surrey Downs,
from houseboats on the River Thames to office blocks in town, close enough to really care as great should always be. We're Southwest London's favourite station, Radio Jackie.
In the last 16 years, I mean, Radio Jackie's done nothing but good, and the events leading to its closure are monstrous.
These fascinating recordings, with a booklet of photographs all about Radio Jackie, are yours for £6. For Europe, it's £8. And with airmail to the rest of the world, £10. Order your copy now from Radio Jackie, 120 London Road, Morden, England, SM4 5AT.
hello to Stuart Allen, writing from Greetland in Halifax, West Yorkshire. Every day, every minute you're on, Brill Signal, Clear Channel 6205. Hi, Radio Fax. Just a line to let you know you're bending my S-meter. Thanks for the nice programmes and keeping free radio alive. It's nice to have a shortwave station on most weekdays, better than the local rubbish the FM pirates put on around here. I normally tune round the bands on Sundays. In fact, I have done so since 1972, when A.J. Burns did his RNI Goes DX programme on the International Service of RNI from the Mebo 2. There's some great stuff on the old 48 and 49 metres. Keep up the good work. I've been listening to Caroline since 1964 from Romsey Bay, 270 from Scarborough and Scotland on 242, etc. I've even made wooden models of the ships. When I was at school, I made a nice one of the laissez-faire, also Mi Amigo and Mebo 2. Let's hope Caroline can sort something out from the Ross. I've got a feeling they will sometime. How about them moving to the Med and linking up their programmes via satellite from there? No MOA. Also, give Radio Merlin a mention on 6240. They aren't bad either. Stay on 6205 forever. Well, Stuart, we will try. And thanks personally for your nice picture of the Ross Revenge, which is going on my wall next to my artist's impression of the Radio Fax site. Though I don't quite go for some of your QSL cards. I turn on to G71HX because G71HX turns me on. And some other uncompromising photographs. Anyway, thanks for your letter. It's Radio Fax 6205, the Sparks programme. Every Monday and Tuesday, we look at technical news and features. From Electronics Weekly, switches shrink to atomic scales. IBM's breakthrough in atomic-sized switches could increase chip complexity by a factor of 1 million. Leon Clifford explains. Atomic-sized electronic switches, the smallest ever made, have been built by researchers working for the US computer giant IBM. A single xenon atom was repeatedly moved back and forth across a gap between two electrodes spaced just several atomic diameters apart, and in the process affected the electrical current flowing between the two electrodes. This experiment, conducted by Donald Eigler, Christopher Lutz and William Rudge at the IBM Research Division's Almaden Research Center in San Jose, California, was reported last month in science journal Nature. It provides some evidence that one day it may be possible to build up transistors to 1,000 times smaller than at present. However, Eigler points out that his team developed a switch, not a transistor, and that he would not link this development firmly with any future technology developments. Moving the xenon atom changed the quantum mechanical tunneling current passing between the two electrodes, just as flicking a wall switch sends a current through an electric light, or flipping a transistor changes the pattern of electrical currents flowing through the electronic circuitry. It's very hard to be able to say what the implications may be, Dr. Eigler told us, but it's a first step and should be seen as exactly that. Central to this breakthrough is the amazing Nobel Prize-winning technology of the scanning tunneling microscope, STM, invented in 1981 by IBM Zurich-based scientists Gerd Binnig and Heinrich Rohrer. It was the STM which first gave scientists their three-dimensional views of atoms on surfaces, which last year allowed Eigler and fellow researcher Arhard Schweizer to move and position individual atoms, which was demonstrated by spelling out IBM in block letters from 35 xenon atoms. Essentially, the business end of an STM consists of a very sharp movable tungsten tip, which hovers just a fraction of a nanometer above a metallic or semiconducting surface. The tip and the surface act as electrodes across which differing voltages can be applied, and between which electrons move due to quantum mechanical tunneling. Details on the surface beneath the tip, such as individual atoms, alter the electric current that flows to the tip, and which can be monitored, and this allows the STM to see atomic scale features. While the STM can also be used as a manipulator by bringing the tip close to individual atoms. Indeed, this breakthrough came out of research aimed at finding better ways of using the STM to move atoms around, according to Eigler. We wanted to pick up and put down atoms to help build atomic structures. We had already developed one sliding process, but it was difficult to use this to build three-dimensional structures, explained Eigler. We very quickly learned how to pick up xenon atoms, and to do this reversibly and in a repeatable way, and at that point we had the idea of a switch. In the experiment reported in Nature's August the 15th issue, Eigler and his colleagues supercooled an STM to just 4 degrees above absolute zero. They positioned its tungsten tip, an atomic diameter above a single crystal of nickel, with a few xenon atoms milling over its surface. All this done in ultra-high vacuum conditions. The tip was made from polycrystalline tungsten wire, while the nickel crystal had been partially covered with a single layer of xenon atoms after it had been cooled. The researchers applied a voltage across these two electrodes, the tip and the nickel crystal, and a xenon atom on the surface jumped across the gap and attached itself to the tip. However, changing the position of the xenon atom affected the resistance between the two electrodes, and hence the value of tunneling current that passed between them. Reversing the polarity of the voltage caused the xenon atom to jump back and the tunneling current to return to its initial level. The scientists could use the STM to flip the tunneling current between two values, one when the xenon atom is on the nickel and the other when it is on the tip. For their first switch, the scientists used the STM to slide a xenon atom to a kink site along the edge of a step in the nickel crystalline structure, the monoatomic step, as they call it. Imagine a gully grooved into the side of a cliff, rising above a flat plain. This helped ensure that the atom would return to the same place on the surface of the crystal each time. The tip was placed half a nanometer, 5 angstroms, or about 1 xenon atom in diameter, to the side of this position. The height of the tip above the surface was adjusted to yield a tunnel junction resistance of 1.5 megohms, with the tip biased at -0.02 volts with respect to the crystal. A 0.8 of a volt jolt was applied to the tip for 64 milliseconds, and that was sufficient to cause the xenon atom to cross the gap and attach itself to the tip and increase the tunnel current. A -0.8 of a volt, 64 millisecond jolt, returned the xenon atom to the surface of the nickel and the tunnel current to its initial level. The three scientists report that the switch operates with pulses that are at least as fast as 20 nanoseconds, and that they have built switches with the xenon atom located on bare nickel and on top of the isolated nickel atoms rising above the surface. The STM itself was used to image the surface of the nickel crystal and check that the xenon atom was present or absent, depending on the state of the switch. In their paper in Nature, the scientists stress that while the imaging and manipulation modes of the STM are critical in constructing the switch, they play no role in its operation. During operation, the STM simply acts as a fixed pair of electrodes. This is important, for it is difficult to see how an entire STM, with its scanning assembly alone, the size of a cricket ball, can be shrunk down onto the surface of a chip, although it is possible to imagine shrinking electrode pairs down onto chips. This would allow electrode sandwiches made from clusters of a few tens or a few hundred atoms, and with a single atom trapped in between as the filling, to store a single bit of information. Manufacturing such devices might prove even more time-consuming if current STM techniques were used to shunt millions of atoms around into precise locations. Indeed, Eigler talks about looking for cage-like molecules with two terminal connections and an atom trapped in the cage. It's entirely speculative whether such a molecule exists or can be produced, he added. But what we've demonstrated required this tremendous apparatus to produce the switch, and we'll need a system that can be mass-produced. Such molecules would be only a few nanometers across, although they would contain a great many atoms. But even if such molecules can be mass-produced and arranged into sensible circuits, there will still be important problems, according to Eigler. For example, he suggests that the electrical transport properties of the atomic-scale conducting wires leading to the devices may not be what we expect. And in their Nature paper, the three scientists point out that there are serious obstacles that must be overcome to create genuinely useful atomic-scale devices. However, they add that prospect of atomic-scale logic and memory devices is nonetheless a little closer. Since the microchip was invented back in 1958, the transistor has halved in size every 18 months, allowing circuit density to double every 3 years, eventually producing today's million transistor memory chips. This switch breakthrough holds out the prospect that the doubling can continue for another 30 years, that chip complexity will increase by another factor of a million, and that transistors or transistor-like devices may become 1,000 times smaller, atomic-sized. And by that time, researchers at IBM and other laboratories will doubtless be trying to figure out what comes next. Suggestions written in xenon atoms on a nickel crystal, please. That report from Electronics Weekly.
I see the people happy.
address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. We'd love to have a letter from you, and we'll send you a reply, which includes a station card, technical information, and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, if you send us 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons, or $1. The address again, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6 7BG, and all letters will get a mention on Sparks, which this week is presented by Andy Burnham and Trevor Brook. So to a letter from Kenneth Munro, who lives in Stamford in Lincolnshire. I picked up your broadcast on Tuesday on 6205 kHz. Although it was largely way above my head, technically speaking, I was interested in much of the programme. I'm a newcomer to shortwave listening and want to learn more about it. Perhaps if I listen to you regularly, I will pick up some of the jargon, and together with some reading, get into the subject more deeply. The only snag is that I don't know what books to ask for, and I can only read them if they are in Braille. If you know anyone who has been along this road and knows about information in Braille, perhaps you could put us in touch with one another. Well, we don't know, but can anyone suggest what is available in Braille, covering, radio, etc.? If you write to us at Sparks, we'll pass your letters on to Kenneth. And hello to all our blind and partially sighted listeners. And while we're talking about Braille, a report from Electronics Weekly. BT turns out bills in Braille. British Telecom has teamed up with the Royal National Institute for the Blind to provide Braille bills for the blind and large print bills for the partially sighted. RNIB boss John Wall praised the move by BT and urged other firms to follow suit. Mike Bett, vice chairman of BT, said, "Our aim is to give blind and partially sighted customers greater privacy and freedom in handling their own affairs." And there's a picture showing David German overseeing the Rhesus Braille printer, which is capable of producing 3,000 pages a day. Both ideas came from BT's special unit, Action for Disabled Customers, which comes up with schemes for users with special needs. On now to a report from the Channel 4 news programme. Can Soviet industry catch up in high technology?
One of the contestants on Soviet TV's best-known quiz show finds himself in luck. The rickety wheel points to P for prize, and that means that he has a choice. Part of the fun lies in the programme host's attempts to buy the mystery prize in the box off the contestant for rubles. What's offered on this occasion is 3,000 rubles, maybe five times an average monthly wage. But the contestant holds out. He's rewarded with a vacuum cleaner of Western manufacture. For him, it's a good deal, as he simply can't buy that in Moscow for rubles. In the city shops, the kind of consumer goods taken for granted in the West are scarce and of low quality, and the people know it. One of the main challenges for the post-Communist Party Soviet economy is to live up to the raised expectations of ordinary people. A lot of the responsibility for that lies with Arkady Volsky of the Inter-Republican Economic Committee, the body which effectively governs the Soviet Union from day to day.
The atmosphere in the country has changed since the coup. There's now an understanding that we have to introduce all our reforms swiftly. We have to introduce the market system. People formerly opposed to these reforms are now speaking in a different voice. So we're optimistic that our reforms will advance much more quickly now.
But the reality is that the greater part of Soviet industry is outdated, overmanned, and not producing what the people of the country need. The Hammer and Sickle Steelworks in northeastern Moscow has 9,000 people on its payroll. But it's noticeable, even on a short visit, that much of the factory simply lies idle, that those workers who are visible lack a sense of purpose, and that much of the equipment is old or in need of maintenance. The Communist Party, with its obsession with centralization and interference, has been blamed for much of the inefficiencies in Soviet industry. This section head, still a party member, denied that the communists, now banned from organizing in workplaces, still have a presence. But nearby, the party notice board still carries the names of the factory committee members responsible for ideology and for political agitation.
One of the worst legacies of previous regime was discouragement of professionalism. People were appointed in accordance with their political or ideological loyalty. Communist apparatchik, as we call them, bureaucrat, who can be chief of any type of organization. He can be chief of theater, then chief of plant, then chief of scientific institution, with the same zero result in terms of productivity.
For Arkady Volsky, the economic way ahead lies in the emerging independent sector.
I believe in the free market, and I believe it can help us out of this crisis. For example, during the first half of this year, overall GNP fell by 12%. But at the same time, productivity in the cooperative sector and private firms went up by 3.8%.
The Krosner Electronics Cooperative is the sort of enterprise Mr. Volsky is pinning his hopes on. Within 2 months of being taken over from the state, the firm had more than doubled its productivity. Part of the reason for that was the new management's policy of raising all salaries, even of unskilled workers, by 200 rubles a month. Profits are ploughed back into developing new products, and the incentive principle is much in evidence.
The wages here depend on how hard you work. You're paid according to productivity. I think this is good for people. They can understand it's their business too. And its success depends on them, not on anyone else.
The non-state sector is still relatively small, but its growth will be a measure of the new leadership's success. The hope is that one day the ruble will buy the things in life that are worth having. Gabby Rado, ITN, Moscow.
We have the ideas, they don't have the money. Small television producers are in trouble as the big channels cut their buying plans, writes Kent Barker. Ruth Pitt, founder and director of Real Life Productions, found three envelopes on the doormat of her Leeds home the other morning. All contained letters rejecting proposals she had put forward. But the most depressing came from Rod Caird, head of factual programmes at Granada Television. "I'm afraid," he wrote, "there is very little prospect of getting any new material on the air until the end of our current franchise period." Real Life was set up 3 years ago after Miss Pitt left Yorkshire Television, where she had been a senior news reporter and presenter. As an independent producer, she has made two successful series for Yorkshire and has a further 12 programmes commissioned for next year's schedules. But pending the new franchise awards, ITV companies have stopped work on almost all independent projects. "It means that a whole year's work for myself and a production team has been on ice since February," she says. "The situation is pretty grim." The news from Granada increases her woes. The independent producers, or indies, had assumed that there would be a rush to commission programmes as soon as the new franchises were announced next October. Mr. Caird's letter suggests it could be the beginning of 1993 before any new programmes appear. Until now, the ITV companies have broadcast about 1,000 hours of independent productions each year, accounting for more than a quarter of the independent sector's total output. Channel 4, the indies' biggest customer, with 2,000 hours a year, is still commissioning, but made an 8% cut in its budget this year, slicing £14 million out of the sector. The BBC currently takes 600 hours of independent programmes, but is perennially short of money and is struggling towards its statutory obligation to contract out 25% of its programmes by 1993. Until its demise last November, British Satellite Broadcasting was planning to take 3,500 hours of independent productions. Britain's independent production sector came into being 10 years ago, with the opening of Channel 4. Now the 700 or so companies in the field are feeling the recession as never before and see further clouds on the horizon. Vincent Hannah, former BBC political reporter and doyen of election broadcasters, recently moved his production company, Viewpoint, into cheaper offices in Clerkenwell. The trick, he says, is to be mobile, to shrink down and grow up again according to the market. Viewpoint is a medium-sized production company with a full-time staff of 8 and a turnover of about £1 million a year. It had 4 major documentary projects on the go at the beginning of this year, but now has only one. "It is a very hand-to-mouth at the moment," said John Bridcutt, co-founder of Viewpoint and producer of Norman Tebbit's Byline programme on disestablishing the church. "We have up to 25 proposals out at any one time, but next to nothing is being commissioned, and the corporate video work we did has dried up to a trickle." The recession has led to a marked decline in advertising revenue this year for the 15 ITV companies, since they directly fund Channel 4 through a levy system. There is likely to be a knock-on effect on next year's Channel 4 budget. "It is going to get worse," predicts Margaret Wyndham Heffernan, director of the Independent Programme Producers Association, IPPA. "Our members are experiencing the recession with a time lag. The next 9 months will be really difficult, and some people will go out of business." While the IPPA's membership of just over 700 companies has remained stable, the number out of production has doubled to almost 10%. The association lobbies hard for the independent sector and was instrumental in securing the 25% independent quota for ITV and the BBC in last year's Broadcasting Act. Despite the almost complete standstill on commissions by ITV companies, the IPPA believes they may actually exceed the quota by the implementation date at the start of 1993. It is less sanguine about the BBC, however. The BBC is still very suspicious of independent producers and afraid it will lose editorial control, says Ms. Wyndham Heffernan. The commission... process urgently needs streamlining if the target of 1,400 hours is to be reached in 18 months' time. There is also concern that the BBC may obey the letter of the law rather than its spirit by simply commissioning its quota of 1,400 hours in 1993 rather than transmitting completed programmes. Many indies remain angry about the sweetheart deals done by the corporation, which allow senior members of staff to leave and immediately pick up valuable commissions as independents. Add to that the decision to hive off Question Time, thereby handing one company a large and lucrative piece of independent work, and the BBC is in bad odour with outside production companies. Not that many will say so too forcibly, since they need whatever work is going. If the immediate prospects are dismal, analysts believe that in the longer term the industry will prove resilient. This is a classic maturing process, says Paul Stiles, head media consultant with KPMG Pete Marwick. We expect around a dozen major players to emerge, perhaps 20 mid-sized companies to go under or to amalgamate, and many of the small companies to revert to being individual producer directors, subcontracting their services on a freelance basis to the bigger outfits. He sees three encouraging signs. The first is the appointment of John Burt as BBC Director General. Mr. Burt is believed to be sympathetic to the independent sector and could push for an increase in the 25% commitment. Second is the possibility of independents getting direct access to NETCO, the new central scheduling system being developed by the ITV companies to replace the old cartel, which chose the programmes to be broadcast on the network. Third, Channel 4 will start selling its own advertising from 1993, which could ultimately improve its finances. In the meantime, the indies are forced to do what they can to survive and to keep up quality as budgets are squeezed. Although there is less money, no one is accepting lower standards, says Ms. Wyndham Heffernan. Producers on location will sleep on the floor rather than pay money for a hotel which could be spent on the screen. Lunch is over. Vijay Armani set up Millennium Productions in 1986. He has an impressive list of production credits, including a five-part Channel 4 series and documentaries for ITV companies. I have never known it so bad, he says at his Carnaby Street offices. I hadn't had a day out of work in 10 years. But since last February, I haven't worked at all. Nothing is being commissioned. His partner, the company's development director, has reverted to freelance tape editing to survive, while Mr. Armani recently put £500 of his own dwindling reserves into a speculative production. A facilities company, also desperately short of work, worked with him to make a half-hour programme of broadcast quality, which would normally have cost up to £40,000. Everyone donated their services, he says. Even Sir Michael Horden agreed to appear for a deferred fee to help us out. Now Millennium is trying to sell the completed off-the-shelf programme to recoup its costs. It is one way to keep the company profile and to keep work going, as other independent producers, less able to ride out the recession, try to avoid going under. That piece about the problems independent television producers are having by Kent Barker.
Estimated time of arrival 9:30 a.m. Been up before the sun and now I'm tired before I even begin. Now you're flying. I got so much work in front of me. Really flying. It stretches out far as the eye can see. I can see. Spend half my life in airports doing crosswords or attempting to sleep. And when the bar is open, then you'll often find a warming a seat.
Now you're flying.
I never find a place where I can stay.
Really flying.
I'd rather be 1,000 miles away. 1,000 miles away. sometimes ain't all that it's cracked up to be. It can be as lonely at the top as at the bottom of that corporate tree. Now you're flying. I'm told I'm going places. Who can say?
That's the Hoodoo Gurus and 1,000 Miles Away, a band that certainly know where their sustain pedals are. It's Sparks from Radio Facts. And there's a new magazine being launched next month, and I have a copy of it right in front of me. It's called Radioactive, the only choice for scanners and CB, it proclaims. Now, just looking inside, there's a couple of articles about scanners. Stuff about marine band radio and listening to aircraft transmissions on a scanner or a airband receiver. Latest developments in the world of communication. Quite a good basic article about antennas. The ifs and buts of using a scanning receiver. Is it legal? And finally, probably the most colourful article is about collecting QSL cards. That's going to be a monthly feature, and they present some very colourful ones, some of the best I've seen, in fact. And a special Sparks offer. If you would like a copy of this magazine, we have 25 to give away. All you have to do is write in saying you would like a copy of Radioactive magazine to the usual address, and the first 25 people to write in will get a free copy. So the address, as ever, is Sparks, Radio Facts, The Forge, Cranley,
England, GU6, 7BG. And listen to Paul's programme. He's going to be reading some articles from the magazine. You're very welcome to write to us whether or not you want a free copy of Radioactive. If you'd like a reply to your letter, which includes a station card, technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please enclose 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1. And the address again is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU6, 7BG. One such letter is from Jim Lowe, who lives in Liverpool. As Merseyside is reputed to be one of the most alive areas outside London, he writes, I have enclosed a list of all the stations heard during August. Well, thanks for that, Jim. We have been doing a monthly report since April 1991 for broadcast on Concept Radio, which is an occasional station in the Merseyside area. The free radio news feature was started in 1985 as an experiment, and it always attracts letters from anoraks locally. Best of luck, keep up the good work. So, brief look at stuff in Liverpool. 100 FM is Kiss FM. Very original frequency and name there. That's mono with a stereo pilot tone, incidentally. An interesting trick. That's been noted most days during August. Programmes are pre-recorded and repeated throughout the week. 100.5 Radio Commodore, obviously computer fans there, broadcast on weekday evenings, but only occasionally. Free radio reports, and on Thursday the 15th there was a feature when a fire officer rang various petrol stations asking them questions about fire extinguishers and various aspects of fire regulations. Sounds fascinating. 100.7 Real Community Radio. First heard on Sunday the 11th of August, were also on around midnight on the 13th and 14th, but on Bank Holiday Monday they changed their name to Hot 100 FM, and they did a phone-in which brought good response with calls from as far away as Blackpool. Another original name here, it's Choice FM on 101 with Soul and Blues, and 101.7 Radio Mersey Waves. And 98.5 on Sunday evenings is Concept Radio in the Liverpool area, playing a variation of music from chart music to 60s and 70s. They plan to return later this year. 104.9 TCR, which stands for Toxteth Community Radio. Their Merseyside's longest-running FM station, playing mainly dance and Asian music. 101.4, finally on the FM dial, is a station heard relaying TCR. On medium wave, North Coast Radio is on 1350. They broadcast Fridays to Mondays, and they did a continuous thing over Bank Holiday Monday, with proceeds going to a local Liverpool hospital. And one listener pledged £100 just to see the studio. He kindly lists us in his reception report and 6280 Live Wire Radio. Don't forget. Thanks for Jim Lowe for sending in that reception report. I'm always happy to read out your reception reports as we weekly do a pirate radio listing. And that was it. I was talking earlier on about how British Telecom have started producing their bills in Braille. But you probably know that BT has introduced a charge of 38p for its directory inquiry calls, although they're still free from call boxes, remember. However, BT's licence requires it to continue to provide a free directory inquiry service to blind customers. Apparently, Barclays Bank has announced that it will be using 250 blind operators to make its directory inquiry calls. Gritting its corporate teeth, British Telecom declared that it was delighted to be able to improve blind people's prospects in this manner. But clearly this was not quite what it had in mind when it offered free directory inquiry calls to the blind. Thanks to the Maplin magazine for that report. Mama loves her baby.
Followers of the television soap Coronation Street will have been watching the story of a pirate radio station. We'll skip the story, which is all about three or four teenagers running a pirate radio station, which seems largely to consist on screen of a ghetto blaster and one or two boxes covered with insulation tape. So, we'll go straight to the denouement of the story.
I know.
Hey, cut out the cheek.
Well, I only said...
Say nothing, and just listen to what Mr. Gilroy's telling you.
Look, you don't realise how close you were to being in trouble. I mean, big trouble with the police.
But we weren't burglars, Grandad.
That's not the point, love.
This pirate radio rubbish. I mean, it's a criminal offence, you know. You could be done for it.
It's not like a proper crime, though, is it, Mr. Gilroy? Not like stealing or anything.
Well, you try telling them that when you're applying for a job and you've got a criminal record.
Do you understand what Mr. Gilroy's saying? Well, you've had your last fling with this lot. It's going under lock and key.
Oh, no!
Until your dad can get shut of it. Do you realise if Bet hadn't been quick and used her brains, you'd have been down at the police station now? Right, we're going home. But first, you can say thank you to Bet.
A familiar story, no doubt, to many people. Soundtrack there of Coronation Street from Granada Television.
So the secret's out at last. Trevor is a closet Coronation Street fan.
If you're considering buying one of the Philips DC777 shortwave car radios from Radio Fax Sales, here's some very good news for you. After some hard bargaining with our suppliers, we're now able to offer these terrific shortwave car radios at the new lower price of only £239. And remember, not only is the DC777 a good quality digital readout shortwave tuner, it also has long wave, medium wave, FM stereo, a high quality stereo cassette deck and powerful stereo amplifier, all in a compact, standard size in-car unit. Shortwave coverage is from 3170 to 21910 kHz continuous. This unit receives a good review in the World Radio and TV Handbook and 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. The new low price, remember, is only £239, inclusive of VAT and delivery in the UK or overseas airmail to anywhere in the world. There's no long wait for your unit to arrive. We hold them in stock. Contact our sales office for more information and a brochure. Telephone number is in England. 0483 275 997. Fax number is also in England. 0483 276 477. Or write to us at Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, GU6 7BG in England.
Hard Disk Recording at Home from Hi-Fi News and Record Review. If you have an IBM-compatible personal computer with hard disk storage, the Card D can give you digital audio recording and editing capability, by Chris Bryant. There is nothing new about storing music signals on a computer hard disk, but only recently it has become feasible to record and edit digital audio on a computer at home. Enthusiasts who wanted to record digitally but could not run to expensive studio equipment may choose to buy a DAT recorder, but this does not make editing easy. With the Card D from Digital Audio Labs, home users can explore the fascinating possibilities of digital editing. As you may know, IBM and compatible personal computers have internal expansion systems. These take the form of slots into which all manner of interesting devices can be plugged. It is quite possible, therefore, to construct a high-quality analog-to-digital and digital-to-analog converter, which would interface with a standard computer. The highly reliable storage medium employed by the computer could then be used to store digital data without the need for error protection. This would allow easy access to the digital numbers, which represent the music, and with the system envisaged, there would be no data compression. Also, the power of the computer to crunch digits could be used to edit easily and accurately. There's a basic problem with this, which will be fairly obvious. Using a sampling rate of 44.1 kHz with 16-bit resolution requires a lot of storage. You need 10.5 megabytes of hard disk per minute of stereo recording time, which incidentally means that you need DOS 4.1 or above to achieve a decent recording length. Until recently, it would cost more than the computer to get a hard disk which would allow a reasonable recording time. And, though I had previously considered trying to build a computer-based recorder myself, it was this simple fact which always put me off. My 44-megabyte hard disk would only be good for 4 minutes. These figures bring home once again the vast storage capacity of the compact disc. However, the cost of hard disk storage continues to fall as the technology improves, and it is now possible to buy an external drive which interfaces to your computer and will give 50 minutes of recording time for a little over £1,000. I'm not suggesting you would use this type of storage to keep your recordings, but it is an excellent transfer and editing medium. When I first came across the commercial device which exploits this capability around a year ago, although for one reason or another I was never able to try it, but a new version of the Card D arrived on my desk earlier this year, and I immediately put it to good use. Currently it can't do everything I would like due to the lack of an SPDIF format output, which would allow direct interface to the outside digital audio world. An I.O. card to provide SPDIF compatibility is promised soon. Even now it may be making its way across the Atlantic. The Card D and related auxiliary items are made in the USA by Digital Audio Labs and brought into the country by SSE Marketing, well known as a supplier of studio and test equipment. The most attractive aspect is the price. The Card D now comes with the editor software at a package price of £575 plus VAT. Although the Card D plugs into ordinary IBM AT and compatible computers, you do need a decent hard disk system to ensure that the data transfer rate is fast enough. RLL, ESDI or SCSI controllers are recommended, as MFM controllers are generally too slow for disk recording. Also, before a recording session, it is worth organising a single continuous section onto which to record. But even taking all this into account, you can still pull together a usable system for roughly the same price as a decent piece of audiophile gear. The analog inputs and outputs on the Card D are via phono sockets, which protrude from the back or side of your computer. The card itself is very neat and tidy, and follows computer design rules rather than those generally found in audio products, but despite this, the audio and digital path are logically arranged and separate. Good quality components are used throughout, and I was heartened to see that a crystal analog-to-digital converter is used. This is a dual 16-bit Delta Sigma A to D converter with 64 times oversampling. It's the device that Meriden has adopted in its ADC, which has rightly found favour with many recently. The input filter buffering and output amplifiers are analogue devices AD712 dual op-amps, selected for their relatively high performance. The DAC used is from Analogue Devices and is a dual 18-bit type running at an 8 times oversampling rate from a Yamaha digital filter. The digital I&O from the card to the computer is by custom digital processing with some associated logic. A neat touch is the ability to have the input DC or AC coupled. There's onboard regulation in the form of 78L devices. Inputs and outputs have ferrite beads on the top side wire jumpers to stop stray radiation emission. Software supplied with the card D gives you all the facilities of a standard tape recorder. You get a choice of 44.1 kHz, 48 kHz and 32 kHz sampling rates. You also get the choice of recording in mono, thus doubling your disk space. As you have the standard DOS filing system available, saving and retrieving recordings is really simplicity itself. If you're serious about recording, you're going to want the extra software called the Editor, which is subtitled Digital Audio Display Editor. A comprehensive manual is supplied with this, helpful and easy to digest even for computer illiterates. The screen is well designed, displaying the function key designations along the bottom and easily accessible pull-down menus along the top. The only criticism here is that it does not support a mouse. It does have an online help, but this is no substitute for the manual. The main window is divided into two sections to show the waveform present on both channels. The top display area is devoted to editing, whereas recordings are shown in the lower window. This software allows you to record, view the waveform you have selected, zoom in, and out on any section you require, pan the wave window left or right, or move the edit cursor through the recording one sample at a time. Cut, paste and mix are all reduced to trivial exercises. The zoom facility takes you right down to the individual sample level, but the screen is rather limiting on the amplitude resolution. This can be expanded using the rescale facility, but you lose the tops of the waveforms. The great thing about the editing system is that you can immediately play your mix back and listening while viewing the waveform on the screen, and there's an undo should you make a mistake. The major criticism I have of DAT recordings from the machines I have heard is its subjective lack of coherence. All the pieces of music are present, but the various strands often do not seem to play together. By contrast, this device manages to produce music which is especially rhythmic and coherent. It does have some problems, but when you consider it's getting its power from the computer's internal supply, which is of course shared with lots of horrible digital systems, it's a wonder it sounds as good as it does. It may sound a good deal better with external supplies. And in conclusion, for the enthusiastic amateur and professional on a budget, this recording device must be deemed a great success. It has potential, and given the availability of even cheaper disk storage, it's a cheap way of making excellent portable recordings. The major plus is that the data stored is an easily accessible non-compressed and non-error-corrected format, which lends itself to easy editing. The addition of the editor software enhances usability. The Card D is undoubtedly a successful exercise in interfacing the audio and computer worlds, and can be recommended for those of you who require this type of facility. That from Hi-Fi News and Record Review, and listen out in the next few weeks on Sparks, because recently I visited the Hi-Fi show organised by that magazine, and there'll be some reports from the show in the next few weeks. You're listening to Sparks on Radio Fax.
walking down my street.
Asthma sufferers at risk from an explosion of dust mites as housed pests have multiplied this summer. In The Observer, Hot Humid Days Spawn Plagues of Insects by Susan Young. The sunny periods and scattered showers of summer 1991 have prompted an explosion in insect numbers and threaten serious health problems for asthmatics during the next few months. For the humid conditions are ideal for insects to breed and thrive. They include the house dust mite, which lives in bedding and carpets and causes most asthma attacks. 2,000 deaths are caused by asthma in Britain every year, and the condition prevents hundreds of thousands of sufferers from leading normal lives. Dr. John Maunder, director of the Medical Entomology Centre at Cambridge University, believes the house dust mite is a serious problem that neither doctors nor the NHS take seriously enough. He said around 40,000 people alive now are going to die of asthma. Hundreds of thousands are very seriously affected by the disease. 5 million are on medication, costing the NHS £450 million each year, which simply suppresses the symptoms, and yet they don't employ a single medical entomologist working on prevention. If it was a bacterium doing the same thing, the government would have 100 fully funded microbiologists by the end of the month. There's no doubt that people are going to be more ill this autumn, and in turn, there is going to be more mortality. But most of these deaths are avoidable. Pillows are the root cause of the problem. Over 4,000 mites per gram of dust have been found on pillows in Birmingham, which is one of the damper parts of the country. A similar experiment in London yielded around 2,500 per gram. The mites feed on skin particles and other human debris, and get their vital moisture supply topped up by the sleeper's breath. In turn, the pillow user is ideally placed to inhale both the mites and their dung, causing wheezing. Doctors have the right idea in sending patients for holidays in Morocco or the Alps, where the air is too dry for the mites to thrive. But the trouble will start again on the first night back at home. Dr. Maunder recommends that asthmatics and sufferers from dust mite allergy should throw away old pillows that are filled with years of accumulated dung and spray replacements with Actomite, which should keep the pests at bay for a year. It isn't just dust mites that are in for a good summer. Most insects adore humid conditions, and those that live indoors, such as cockroaches and cat fleas, find such weather particularly beneficial, since water supplies are usually a problem. Dr. Maunder warns cat owners that a population explosion of fleas is likely, given the weather conditions. Not only are they breeding faster, but the maggots are maturing into adult fleas more quickly. The best answer is to spray the house with methoprene. Putting pesticides on the cat is almost useless, he says. The trouble is that people with cats often become immune to the bites and don't notice them anymore. Friends are too embarrassed to tell them, and so they don't visit. The only person who does visit is the vicar, and he's wearing Wellington boots to avoid getting bitten. And so the owners get lonely and acquire more cats, says Dr. Maunder cheerfully. And although the flea season is only just starting, both councils and Rentokil report soaring call-out figures from desperate homeowners. Other household pests that are thriving include cockroaches and Faroe ants, which infest many high-rise estates and are almost impossible to dislodge because of the many hiding places where they can lurk. Ordinary ants have also proved a problem. Sales of just one treatment chemical have risen by a third this year, and nests are on the increase. Hazards outside the home are multiplying rapidly as well. Mosquitoes and gnats can use the smallest puddle of water for breeding, and wasps are also thriving. Their peak nuisance period is during the month of September, when the queens die and the workers are both hungry and at a loose end. Head lice are another unexpected summer hazard. Roger Crowe, marketing manager of Wellcome Pharmaceutical, says most children are not infected at school, but by adults during the school holidays. The likeliest culprits are doting grandmothers, who do not know they are infected. For some reason, nits avoid adult men altogether. It isn't just unfriendly wildlife that is benefiting from the damp summer. Hoverflies, which look like small wasps but are harmless and eat aphids, have migrated to Britain in vast numbers. Some butterflies and moths are also enjoying a good summer. One in particular, the white letter hair streak, which is normally a rarity, has become commoner than the white peacock. Others that are doing well include the white admiral, the peacock, and the holly blue. Unusual moths include the great brocade, normally resident in Scandinavia, but recently spotted in East Anglia, and the extremely rare black-veined. English Nature has observed that dragonflies are thriving, but bumblebees are not so common as last summer. And ordinary householders have noticed the epidemic of woodlice, not strictly an insect, but a land-living shrimp, and earwigs, so-called because of the shape of their wings. Insect experts are perhaps the only humans delighted by this summer's crop of creepy crawlies. Dr. Maunder has just started his summer holidays, and he is planning to spend them observing the wildlife in his back garden. Magnifying glass in hand, he enthused, "I've seen some wonderful insects this year, including a scorpion fly, which is unbelievably primitive, just like seeing a dinosaur." That article, not about leeches this time, but about insects, by Susan Young in The Observer.
And some What's On information. On the 24th, 25th and 26th of October, in CNIT Paris and La Défense, it's Vive la Radio, 10 years of FM. An organisation called Vive la Radio, holding an exhibition, conference, lectures and debates. This association has the object of celebrating the 10th anniversary of the diversity of FM radio in France. That's on the 24th, 25th and 26th of October at Paris La Défense in France.
A critical piece here, all about Radio Caroline, published in The Broadcaster. Adios, mi amigo. The romantic days of Radio Caroline are sadly over. It has now been off air for months, the longest period in its history. It is now a far cry from the Caroline Cash Casino days of the 60s, with the likes of Keith Skews and Tony Blackburn, the days when every other radio was locked into the offshore pirate, and on a sunny day you couldn't walk the beach without hearing the Caroline bell. The evenings could be spent with Percy Sledge, and footprints would appear on the car windscreen to the tones of Johnny Walker. But the Mi Amigo, the original ship that housed Caroline, is long gone. It has been replaced today by the Ross Revenge, a rotting vessel with an anchor chain that has almost rusted away, a rudder that has almost fallen off, and engines that don't work. Even if they did, there is nobody on the ship capable of piloting it. With presenters lighting fires on the deck due to the navigation lights failing, and living from hand to mouth in the hope that better times will come, it seems unlikely that the Phoenix will have the energy to rise again. And who cares? A treacherous piece for many, I'm sure. That is published in the Plat du Jour column of The Broadcaster magazine, and it's not signed, so I can't tell you who wrote it. All I can tell you is that the editor of the magazine is Richard Linton Porter, and contributors for this edition are listed as Tim Blackball, Michael Bucht, Mark Wesley, Maureen Winnall, and Tony Grundy. Well, I'm still thinking about the footprints on the windscreen, but it's not entirely an accurate piece, is it, Andy? The station's certainly been off the air far longer between the time when the Mi Amigo sank and the Ross Revenge was acquired and constructed. That's one mistake for a start, isn't it?
I'd also disagree with the statement that the engine is no longer functioning. However, it is true that there's no one there to operate it. You're listening to Sparks. And don't forget, if you'd like a free copy of a new Scanner and CB magazine called Radioactive, please write in to us at Sparks saying you'd like a copy. It's called Radioactive. And the first 25 people will get one. If you're not one of the lucky ones, look out in your newsagent. Price £1.40.